Welcome to Sports Connections with David Smale, a podcast that brings fun and interesting connections throughout sports. As an author and sports journalist, David has been interviewing fascinating people in sports for more than 40 years. Now here's your host, David Smale.
John Vallely was recruited to play basketball at UCLA in 1968. After averaging 26 points per game and earning junior college All-American honors at Orange Coast College. When he got to UCLA, he had joined a team that was coming off back-to-back national championships and four in the last 5 years. The focus of that team was maybe the greatest college basketball player of all time, Lew Alcindor, later became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And in 1969, UCLA won its third straight championship and Curtis Rowe. After his 2 years at UCLA, John played two seasons in the NBA and had one final pro appearance in Belgium. Some will say UCLA had a huge advantage being in the western part of the country without a lot of competition at that time, but that's revisionist history. UCLA had no real competition because Coach John Wooden was head and shoulders above every other coach. He didn't accidentally get the likes of Alcindor, Bill Walton, and Vallely. The best players wanted to play there because of the team's success. John had a long career away from basketball and has an inspiring story about being a two-time recipient of a stem cell transplant. John, welcome to Sports Connections.
Thank you, David. It's nice to be here with you.
Let's start with the UCLA connection. Why did you choose to play at UCLA? You could have been probably a bigger star had you gone elsewhere and not been on the team with superstars like Kareem.
Well, by the way, the West was full of good coaches as well. We had Jerry Tarkanian at Long Beach State, Tex Winter up at Washington, Bob Boyd at USC. These places also recruited me, but there was something about getting a chance to play for such a great coach in John Wooden, and maybe I'd get to play with Lew Alcindor as well, the greatest center of college basketball, certainly at that time.
Okay, and then you played with UCLA, you were there for 2 years, and you played in two Final Fours, and obviously won two national championships. Does either one stick out, or do they both stick out for different reasons?
Both championships were really special to me. First of all, I was able to make the starting team on that 1969 championship team that was full of players that had played at UCLA for 4 years, some of them 5 years, and to be in the starting backcourt was really a nice position to be in. So getting to go to the championship with Lew Alcindor with high expectations, sometimes it was tough because we were trying to keep from losing instead of trying to win. And it's an unusual sort of a circumstance. But then the second team was actually maybe more special to me because we were the team without and the expectations weren't as high. I was also the captain of that team. And so I suddenly was in a position as the elder statesman on the team to have an attitude, to have an approach that would make sense. And I found myself starting to use John Wooden's pyramid of success at that time and focusing on simply the things that I could control, which is being the best I could be, working on the fundamentals, having the attitude that the pyramid of success presented and all its characteristics on how you could be the best person you can be, knowing that that's all you can control.
Right.
That there might be a team better than us, but what an opportunity to be the team without and to carry on and to win again in 1970.
I want to talk a little bit about each of those teams. First, the 69 team, playing with somebody of Alcindor's abilities, where you knew if you get into him, it was almost an automatic 2 points with his sky hook and his ability, he's a good passer. What was it like to play with somebody like Lew Alcindor?
Well, David, I have to tell you, it might seem strange, but yeah, it was nice to be able to throw the ball into him, but he was being double and triple teamed. So Lynn Shackelford, who was a great shooter on my team, and I was expected to be a good shooter as well and scored points. The cool thing about playing with Lew Alcindor was if your guy got by you, good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck having to go up against Lew Alcindor at 7'3" or whatever he was, you know. And so you always had sort of a confidence that you played your defense, but you certainly got some great players behind you on defense. And I think defense is really the key to winning in those sorts of games, those big games.
Yeah, we tend to focus on the offense and what he could do on the offensive end. but there are so many great pictures. You know, I did a book on UCLA basketball back in 1989. It was basically on Pauley Pavilion. It focused mostly on the men's basketball program there. But there are so many pictures of him. He was not only big, he was athletic. I mean, he was not clogging up the middle. He was a very great athlete, wasn't he?
He really was. You know, if a guy would drive past me and go up for some sort of a layup, Kareem would come from the weak side, or Lou, yeah. Lou would come from the weak side. And you've seen the picture of him catching the ball with his head by the rim,
yeah,
and his arm reaching up above the white box that's right there behind on the backboard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he'd catch the ball. He wouldn't just block it. He would catch it. And then, you know, the way we'd go. So,
and he was a great passer too, wasn't he?
He really was. He was very interested in finding the open man at all times. It made his job easier in the post. Being double and triple teamed all the time, he had to always be looking because he didn't want to charge somebody or travel or something like that. He was very interested in connecting with everybody. He knew the team was bigger than just him.
Yeah. It's interesting. I spent some time when I worked on that book, spent some time talking to Sidney Wicks. And Sidney, obviously a very talented player, but about as different a personality as you could possibly have from Alcindor. Alcindor pretty much reserved, kept to himself, you know, not real talkative. And Sidney was the life of the party. Just compare having to adapt as a guard, having to adapt your game to a different personality. We don't always think about how personality enters into a team game, but it does. Just talk about the difference between those two players.
Well, Sidney was a fun-loving guy, and he had his own way of doing things. And it actually started out in, I think, his junior year when he showed up on the basketball court in the early days, and he had a goatee and big mutt chop sideburns and a big afro, and coach had these rules about facial hair, and he didn't yeah. like that. And so I remember being down on Pauley Pavilion floor shooting, and Coach Wooden walks into practice, and Sidney's at one end with Curtis Rowe, and they're shooting hoops, and a coach goes directly down to Sidney and says, "Sidney, you know my rules about facial hair." And Sidney says to coach, "Well, you don't have the big guy this year. You're going to need me, coach." And I remember Coach Wooden, because I'd walked down there. He says to Sidney, he says, "We really need you this year, and we could really use you. So, but unless you get up into that training room and get those facial hairs cut off, you won't be playing for the Bruins this year." The next thing you saw was the 6'9" superstar on our team running up the steps of Pauley Pavilion to get into Ducky Drake's training room where he could get his facial hairs cut off.
Yeah.
And within about 10 minutes, he was back in time to start practice, and away we went. And I knew that once Sidney caved in to coach, that there was going to be a good chance that we would all connect.
You know, just talk a little bit about that 1970 team. You mentioned that you were the captain, so you were one of the leaders on that team. Just talk about how long it took for you guys to merge. I don't know if that's the best word, but to blend together, and maybe it was right away, as you were just talking about. How long did it take for you guys to become a team rather than a bunch of individual stars?
At UCLA, the way Coach Wooden coached and began his practices, began his approach to life, he set the stage for you to have to play as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did not play as a team, he would find somebody on your roster that did play that way. So we all knew that you were going to have to respond to his direction, which were the basic fundamentals of the game of, mm-hmm. of not throwing the behind the back or over the head or, you know, strange stuff. He expected things to be done properly without turnovers. So if you're turning the ball over, you weren't going to be playing for Coach Wooden's basketball team. You needed to cooperate right away, or you would find yourself sitting on the bench. And it was as simple as that. It didn't make any difference which person it was. So we all knew that. And I think he had to respond to that. So he set a precedent for us.
Okay. And now the 1970 Final Four, you and I've talked about this before, is the only one in history where three of the four teams made their debut appearance in that year's Final Four and have never been back. The other three were Jacksonville, New Mexico State, and St. Bonaventure. Yet UCLA was the one with the least star power. Jacksonville had Artis Gilmore, 7'4", shot blocking machine, great inside player. New Mexico State had Sam Lacy. St. Bonaventure had Bob Lanier with the biggest feet I've ever seen in my life. UCLA was the one without the star power. What do you remember about that Final Four?
It almost felt like, and I can say it now as I feel it today, we had everything to gain and nothing to lose. I believe that Jacksonville University was rated a little higher than us most of the season.
Okay.
And so when we got on the court, there's a couple of things that happened. First of all, the day before the final game, each team had about a half hour, 45 minutes to practice in the stadium. And Jacksonville actually practiced before us. And they went out there. And we walked in just at the end of their practice, our team did. And there was a boombox playing and music going, and everybody was just loose as a goose and having the time of their life. And then they walked off the court, and then we had our practice, which was about 20 minutes of perfection without any goofing around, all fundamentals, all just basic concepts of fast breaking and good passing, good footwork, you know, no messing around whatsoever. So I didn't know that we would prevail in that game because they did have all that star power, and we had a good team. Mm-hmm. And we weren't sure we would be able to beat Jacksonville University. But I remember that first half when we kind of scooted ahead of them, I think, by a few points. And then at halftime, we had a little talk at the middle of the court. And we just decided that we were going to go and kick the stuff out of them. And we beat them.
Yeah.
And by the way, Sydney had I've been with Artis Gilmore since. And teased him a little bit about his confrontation with Sydney. And Sydney, probably because Artis was so high when he shot his shot, he'd actually shoot it down at the basket. And Sydney may have intercepted one or two of those that the referees didn't pick up on.
Yeah.
But like Sydney always says, hey, they didn't call it.
Oh, that's great. I want to reconnect with Sydney if possible.
Sydney's really a fun guy. I've always really thought he was a neat guy and a fun teammate.
I interviewed you the first time when I did a feature for the 2020 Final Four program, which obviously never was published. But all three of the other teams involved that year said they should have won, but, and then there was something happened. And I remember your reaction to that. At the time, what's your reaction when somebody says, well, I think Bob Lanier got injured in the regional final, and so he wasn't full strength for St. Bonaventure, and I don't remember what was going on with Sam Lacy, but there was something where each one of those teams said, we would have won, but what's your reaction to that?
There was a comment I always enjoyed, shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
Has nothing to do with reality.
Yeah.
And so all we can do is control what we can control. And the result was as we saw. So.
Okay. And that's the one I wish that program had been run just for that quote alone. That was a classic one. You've talked about it. UCLA was successful because of Coach Wooden's system. Whether he had a superstar, and some people will say there was always a superstar, it was just degree of superstar, but whether he had a superstar or two, or it was a team without, the system still focused on everybody being the best they could be and controlling what they could control. Did that make it easier for you in 1970 when you guys didn't have Lou Alcindor in the middle? The system.
Yes, it certainly made it easier because you could then, of course, just continue to focus on the fundamentals. And you got to remember that each year we started out by learning how to put on our socks and shoes properly. And that basic fundamental carried over into his pyramid of success. We never talked about winning. We never talked about losing. He never talked. He used those vocabulary words were not used in our system. He really wanted to focus on us finding our personal best in every aspect of the game that we could control. So from day one, besides the talk on learning how to put on our socks, I'll never forget Lou Alcindor saying, "Come on, coach, this not the sock story again." It was his fourth time to learn how to put on his socks correctly. And a lot of people think that's just sort of strange and kind of weird. And so did I. I thought coach lost his marbles. I thought we should be working on the fast break and the zone press. And here he was telling us how to put on a pair of socks. But if you look back on it now the way I do, I see that those fundamentals of how he taught the game and how he taught us how to approach the game mentally are fundamentals that can be used in every aspect of your life. And that's what I'm most appreciative of.
And we'll get into some of those other theories here, but I've got to ask you, people have heard that and say, you know, they know that I knew Coach Wooden late in his life, and they'll say, did he really teach the players how to put on their socks? Why was that important? Why was that something he did every single year?
Well, I think one of the more entertaining parts of that story is that I teased him as an adult many years after I was taught how to put on my socks. And I said, "Coach, you were just doing the sock story to line us up so you could tell us the story about the pyramid of success and to not focus on winning and losing, but focusing on personal success." And he says, "No, I wasn't. I was trying to teach you how to put on a pair of socks. I didn't want one of you to get a blister as a result of not knowing how to put on your socks properly or to tie your shoes properly. So when you got on the basketball court, I didn't want you to experience downtime as a result of not knowing that basic fundamental." So to me, it made a perfect connection of the parable of socks and then the pyramid of success. But to him, it was strictly about putting on socks.
And by the way, John, that was a very, I don't know if you were intending it, but that was a pretty good imitation of Coach Wooden. You had that same look about you. And I remember asking him questions sitting in his living room, and he would be incredulous that I would ask a question like that, you know, I would say I was trying to be funny, and he would say, "No, that was really why I did this," and things like that. Just talk about, and this is a two-part question, and I'll say both parts, and then we'll go back to the first one, the influence that Coach Wooden had on you on the court, and then we'll follow it up with the influence he had off the court. So start with the influence that Coach John Wooden had on you on the court.
I felt that when I went to UCLA, that if I did what I was told and did it without issue, that I might have a chance to play. And I knew I could shoot the ball well, and I knew I would fit in with a team that needed a shooter like you'd need with Lou Alcindor as your center. And so I just simply did the work that I needed to do leading up to the week before we played Purdue in the home opener. And it was that week before that coach pulled me aside and said, "What do you think about starting against Purdue in the home opener?" And I just remember almost glassing off at the point of him asking that question and saying, I said this, "Coach, isn't that what this is all about?" Hmm. And I went on to practice. So I felt like if I did the job that was asked of me, that something good may come from it.
And he, you know, he instilled, I mean, that's kind of interesting that he would ask you your opinion rather than pulling you aside and saying, "John, I want you to start." He, from what I understand from talking to other players through the years, he treated his players, he obviously wanted to have the authority, he wanted the players to respect him, but he treated his players with respect. Is that true? And how did that impact you with your teammates?
I really do believe that he expected you to have self-respect. Mm-hmm. And he sometimes would challenge us to try to build us up mentally. You know, everybody has a break in confidence from time to time. And sometimes you just have to have it pulled out of you. But Denny Crum was also good at that. I'll never forget him during a game saying to me, "John, during an important part of the game, just you're going to go out and make these two free throws." And, you know, that sense of confidence. But then when Coach Wooden asked me, "What do you think about starting?" I mean, can you imagine Paulie Pavilion, Lou Alcindor, John Wooden, and "John, what do you think about starting against Purdue with Rick Mount in the home opener?"
Yeah, I was going to ask if Mount was still there. So
So what an opportunity to receive that. I remember just being so excited about the rest of practice. You know, it's like, what? Did this just really happen?
Was it hard for you to focus the next few minutes, the next few days? I mean, or was
I was, David, I was really excited, and I had a good game against Purdue. I scored 19 points. Nobody knew me from anybody.
Yeah.
And I had some open shots and made them. And so kind of solidified a starting position on that team.
Now, when I first got to know Coach Wooden, it was for with doing the book. And then later in 89, I delivered the book to his apartment there in Van Nuys. And I was there for about 3 hours. And it was the Friday after the earthquake in San Francisco, like 2 days earlier. And we talked about earthquakes for about a half hour. And we talked about basketball for about 15, 20 minutes. And then we talked about other stuff. We talked about our shared faith. We talked about things in life. Basketball is just a small part of his life. So I want you to answer this question with that in that context. Talk about the influence that Coach Wooden had on you off the court.
Well, I think the pyramid of success, for example, can be used in every aspect of our life. Mm-hmm. I married in 1970, which was right after the 1970 championship season. And I had signed a contract to play with the Hawks. And when you think about what the pyramid of success meant on the court, as far as seeking your personal best, the fundamentals of loyalty and cooperation and developing skills and communication and so forth, all those things were really valuable in the marriage. And I often didn't understand why others didn't embrace that as well in their life. But I found the pyramid of success to be really helpful in that part of it. And actually the pyramid of success helped me find my faith later on as a 28-year-old, 29-year-old. So Coach Wooden's teachings, and he regarded himself as a teacher, not a coach,
right,
were very useful if you were willing to embrace those basic fundamentals.
How have you been able to share those principles with people with whom you've had an influence? Obviously, as a UCLA basketball player, you had quite a platform, and then later as an NBA player, so you probably had influence. How have you been able to share those principles with other people?
Well, I actually coached in professional basketball in Brussels, Belgium. I used it there. I coached my children in soccer, basketball, and baseball, not my daughter in baseball, but she liked to play soccer. And so I used to bring all the parents together and tell them that this is what I wanted to teach them, the basic fundamentals of life, as well as the fundamentals of the sport. And so I used it that way. In my business, I actually had Coach Wooden come in and speak at one of my businesses. And it became a popular way of thinking about dealing with our communication within the retail business that we had. So marriage, business, faith, the pyramid of success and its teaching could be helpful in every part of that.
I talked to you one time about your relationship with Corey Close, the women's basketball coach at UCLA. And she told me how influential, she didn't mention you by name right away. She talked about this former player that when she first got the job, this former player who played for Coach Wooden came and talked to her about priorities with her, you know, in her coaching and things like that. And then she mentioned your name. And I said, I've talked to John before. I know who you're talking about. To me, that's a great example of being able to share that with someone in a very related field. Yeah, you can do it. You can transpose it to marriage. You can transpose it to business, stuff like that. But you're able to convey those messages to Coach Close in a realm that's very close to how those things develop with Coach Wooden.
Well, I've shared my thoughts about the pyramid many, many times. I've done a lot of public speaking on it. Everybody doesn't always adopt these ways of thinking.
Right.
You can still find all the coaches in our country focusing on just winning and losing.
Yeah.
But you can't just say we're going to win. You can only say that here's what we can control. And if we can do all these things well, maybe we will have a chance at winning. It's not that Coach Wooden didn't want to win, David. I mean,
right. Gosh,
he wanted to win more than anybody. We all did, but we just didn't focus on that because that That was a result of so many other things.
Right.
And this is what Wooden was teaching. And this is what I believe he was teaching that you can use in your marriage. Focus on those things that you can do well that help yourself mentally mm-hmm. and physically. Because he'd always say, and I love this comment, there'll always be someone smarter than you, someone not as smart, someone faster, someone slower. But those are not important thoughts. Never compare yourself to another person. You always want to just find the best you can produce with what you have been given by God.
One of my favorite quotes that he told me was, we were talking about somebody playing better than anyone expected them to do. And I made the silly comment of, you know, them giving 110%. And he quickly, very politely, but quickly corrected me. And he said, no one can give 110%. The goal as a teacher, and you're right, he always called himself a teacher, not a coach. The goal as a teacher is to bring out in your pupils the ability to get as close to 100% as possible. Just talk about that aspect of it. You can't give more than you can give. The idea is to give as much as you've been, as you have the ability to do.
And if you've given as much as you have the ability to give, chances are you may be getting closer to 100%. But to say I'm going to give 110% or 115%, my wife and I always laugh because we both grew up in the system. Whenever we hear coaches get on TV and bark about that, it's like, what are you doing? Telling us more stories again? Let's just talk about, could we just talk about the facts? The facts are you could only give 100%. And being that the human being is a fallen person, it's not likely he gives 100% or she all that often. But we could get awfully close, as my wife has over many, many years.
Yeah, I'm part of the I'm Married Over My Head Club too, John. So I know you've done it years for years and many, many times. Can you just go through the individual elements briefly in the pyramid of success?
Well, the pyramid of success starts with the goal of competitive greatness, which is at the top. It's at the apex of the pyramid of success. And competitive greatness is being the best you can be when your best is needed. And there's a grading way that you do that. You have to truly understand the meaning of success. Success is defined in the dictionary as accumulation of wealth or the attainment of some position of political power, some sort of power. Coach didn't like that definition. He said that success in his mind was the peace of mind that you get when you know you've done your best to become the best you're capable of becoming. Peace. Mm-hmm. This is an important word, absence of conflict. Peace is defined as absence of conflict about the effort that you've given to become the best you're capable of becoming. Now, nobody's ever going to know whether you achieved this but you. Your wife will never know. Your kids will never know. Your players will never know. The coach will never know if you've achieved this. He says, but I'd recommend that you make an effort to become the best you're capable of becoming. And here's some of the things that you can do to help control that. Learn to work hard, and industriousness, enthusiasm, the two cornerstones of the pyramid of success. And if you go through the rest of it, friendship, loyalty, cooperation, I won't labor on every one of these, but I would just say that all these characteristics that he elected to put into his pyramid of success, and especially team spirit, eagerness to sacrifice personal interests for the glory of the team, or eagerness to sacrifice personal interests for the glory of the couple or the family. Mm-hmm. How could a man take that and use it in his life? Teamwork. And so many times we break down in these special areas. So if you go and practice the characteristics of the pyramid of success and you climb up from the bottom, the foundation, industriousness, friendship, loyalty, cooperation, and enthusiasm, as you climb up, if you develop each of these characteristics in the pyramid of success, you'll probably find yourself with a sense of poise and confidence. You'll become perhaps a better human being with confidence about who you are as a person, especially when you develop those skills underneath. So competitive greatness, you know, it doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a great deal of work. And I always used to think of this, no elevator to the success. You got to take the steps in the pyramid of success.
That's a great way of putting it. You had a very successful business career. Just talk about what you accomplished after basketball.
Well, first, when I was playing in basketball, Karen and I just had one car. We saved every dollar that we were making at the time because we didn't know how long my career would last. I had not the greatest body. My knees were starting to fall apart. And so I thought that if I could leave the sport with some capital, I might be able to start my own businesses. And so I was able to get in with a couple of partners and start a retail business and also a manufacturing business. And then while I was playing, I was invested in some apartments. And so I was asking a fella who was working with me on my basketball contract, who was also investing money back in Chicago, why and how we were in these different apartment buildings. And I started to learn a little bit about real estate as well. So when I got out of playing, then I actually got a real estate license so that I understand the vocabulary and a little bit about investing in real estate. And then these other business opportunities came up. And so in the businesses, actually the businesses where we employed others, I tried to implement the pyramid of success in the concept of creating a culture mm-hmm. in each of the businesses. And I thought that was a better way to have a business than to one that did not have that culture. And so it was useful because even today, some 40 years later, I talked to some of the employees and they say, I still remember the days when we talked about those characteristics. And it was so great to have Coach Wooden come down and speak to us.
Yeah, it's easy to understand hearing you explain it, but I don't think people will recognize that, you know, there's no elevator to success in business. There, you know, you have to take the steps. You have to work as a team. You know, if you put your own interests ahead of the business's interests, you know, those things will fail. You have to put on your socks properly in business, you know, so you don't get sidetracked with blisters, you know, to use that metaphor and stuff like that. It's really cool to see how, and I know a lot of his players did that. I've talked to several former players through the years, but it's really cool to see how you use those things because he taught those principles. Basketball was part of it, but it wasn't the focus, was it?
It really wasn't. I really think he wanted to help us in trying to understand how to be a better person. And certainly everybody's going to go their own way and find their own way. Mm-hmm. But and he said, by the way, you don't have to embrace this pyramid of success. This is just something that I've developed over many, many years in my life. And I found it really useful, he said. Yeah. If you think it's useful, I'd love to see you use it. But that was as much as he would say. He didn't demand that we learn the pyramid of success and use it. And I could name several players that I know have not used it, but yeah. It hasn't worked out well for them. Not as well as it could have, let's put it that way.
Here's my favorite Coach Wooden story, besides some that you've already shared, is when he was at Indiana State and he wanted to go to a, you know, what we today call a major school or a Power Five school. And he really wanted to stay in the Big Ten because he had played at Purdue. And I think it was University of Minnesota had been talking to him about accepting their position, but they just kind of dragged their feet. And so he accepted a position with a phone call at UCLA. And 15 minutes later, his dream job at Minnesota came through and they offered him the position. And being a man of his word, he said, no, I've given my word to UCLA. I'm sorry, I'm moving to California. Just, I know this is a lot about Coach Wooden and I want it to be about you too, John, but it's just, he had an influence on me, even though I didn't know him until he was in his mid 80s. But just talk about the fact of living up to what you say you're going to do.
Well, the scripture tells us to let our yes be yes and no be no. And that's why I believe Coach Wooden took the approach he did when he had that coaching opportunity. So, you know, that sheds a lot of light on who Coach was. I mean, he didn't want to drive out to Los Angeles and he got out here and saw a freeway and that really didn't interest him a whole lot, but yeah. He came out here and fulfilled his responsibility. So I just think that Coach's, again, these characteristics are just so valuable when you approach them with seriousness.
Last thing I want to ask you about, I mentioned in the introduction that you had two stem cell transplants. You and I have talked before about the fact that my wife is a two-time leukemia survivor, had two stem cell transplants. Just talk about the story behind that, you know, why you had to have that, and then also how the how those same principles helped you in your recovery.
Well, we went through the loss of a child, first of all. She was diagnosed when she was 9 years old, and she fought till she was 12, just before her 13th birthday. And so we had the feeling of what it was like to walk next to a person fighting cancer. Never did I dream that I would then be diagnosed later on in my life with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so I went through the early parts of receiving chemotherapy, which failed. And then I had to go up to the Hutchinson Cancer Center up in Seattle to do my first transplant, which is called an autologous stem cell transplant. That's where they use your own stem cells,
right,
to go through the process. And if you don't know what that is, it's taking stem cells out of the bloodstream, freezing them, giving the patient radical chemotherapy. And then after that chemotherapy is finished, they give you your stem cells back, which restarts your immune system so that you can carry on with your life. I did that the first time at the Hutch and it failed. And then I had to go and make a decision about a year later because the disease clearly reappeared, and I had to go through more treatment. And then I had to do what was called allogeneic stem cell transplant, where you would receive the stem cells from another person. And so it turned out that I went to the Hutch, or to the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas. And my best match was a gentleman who was living just outside of Frankfurt, Germany, a couple years younger than me, but his stem cells were available. So they went back to him, got the 5 million stem cells, put them in a bag, transferred them over to the MD Anderson Cancer Center, where I was sitting in wait after I'd been given radical chemotherapy again, and then waiting for his stem cells to generate the immune system again, that would, his stem cells would dominate even to today, now some 15 years later. So I feel really blessed that somebody else thought to participate in the registration of stem cells, or the ability to give to others. And that saved my life for sure. And in the process, I learned a lot about my relationship with God and how important it is when you don't know whether you're going to live or you're going to die, and how you deal with it. And to see how my wife was just so amazing, and so many people and friends were so amazing around me praying for me, and to feel that and to know what that's about. And I'll never forget asking God what he wanted me to know about that. And he said, and it came back to me in a generation of this prayer, well, what is it that you're thinking about, John? And I said, I'm thinking about all the people that have made a nice thought for me and prayer for me. And it just came through again that, well, what do you think you ought to do about that? And I said, I think I should be praying for each of them. So there I was at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas, praying for other people while I was laying in bed, not knowing whether I would get through the transplant or not. So that's kind of ground zero when you go through these difficult circumstances. And there's so much to be learned in that process about who we are as people, what's important in life. And that's my experience in that area of cancer. And since then, by the way, we've done a great deal of work raising money for children's cancer research for the Dribble for the Cure that we do at UCLA and also at St. John's University, and it may expand some more. But we've raised some millions of dollars to support children's cancer research. So my connections to UCLA, and also when Steve Lavin was back at St. John's, we got started with the Dribble for the Cure back there. And so we've been raising money at both universities each year with a special, what's called Dribble for the Cure event on each campus, raising money for children's cancer research and the Pediatric Cancer Research Foundation, which I sit on the board of and have for the last 35 years.
I mentioned that my wife's a two-time leukemia survivor. The second time, I remember that she went from 0% leukemic, 0.3% her own cells and all donor cells in January to in mid-March, 50% her cells, 50% donor cells, 30% leukemic. And they told us, you know, that she had to get back in the hospital. And I remember that she was in the hospital for 4 weeks getting the robust chemo treatment. And she was home for 2 weeks while we waited. They found another donor in record time. And so she was only home for 2 weeks, but the day before she went in, we were at the doctor's office, and I said, I'm a sports writer. I deal with statistics. What are her chances of surviving this? She's 3 years older. She's, you know, not in as good health as she was before. And he said, well, I didn't want to share this with you, but she has a 25% chance of not making it through the night. And I said, well, then why are we doing it? He said, because she has a 0% chance of being here in a month if we don't. I said, okay. And go on. And he said, she has a 40% chance of not making it out of the hospital after 4 weeks. And he said, everything put together, she has a 25% chance of being here in a year. And of course, I had the deer in the headlights look, and he was looking like, you know, you asked, so I had to tell you. We look over at my wife, and she's smiling. And he says, Tammy, why are you smiling? And she says, someone has to make up the 25%. So those statistics don't include me. And he said, I think you'll be part of that 25% because of your faith, your toughness, and your willingness to do exactly what we tell you. And it'll be 9 years in May. And she spends her free time mentoring new patients who are going through this the first time and inspiring them. And so one of the things I want to wrap up with this, one of the highlights for me, having walked alongside her for two different journeys with this, was in the spring of 2018, so 6 years after her second transplant, I got to meet her donor. He lives near Charlotte. I was covering the NCAA basketball tournament in Charlotte. I was actually sitting courtside when UMBC beat University of Virginia. But during halftime of the North Carolina game, because he was a Carolina fan, I went up into the concourse at the Charlotte Arena and met this guy. And here we are, two men in our late 50s, hugging each other, crying, as I was thanking him for saving my wife's life. And he said, what else would I do? So I understand you got to meet your donor in Germany. Tell us that story.
Well, actually, the daughter of the donor was living on the East Coast. And so Mr. Hoffmeister and his wife actually flew over to the East Coast to see their daughter. And so when I found out about this, and by the way, you don't get to find out for right. 2 years.
Right.
It takes 2 years before you get past the security clearance,
right?
Because they don't want people taking advantage of each other and so forth. My wife and I were invited to come back and spend a little bit of time with them. And it was so exciting to get to meet Mr. Hoffmeister because, again, he was 2 years younger than me, but he is a man who doesn't speak English and I don't speak German. And if you can imagine what it was like to approach the place they were staying and walking into a room and seeing that this is the guy
yeah.
who gave you the cells so that you could actually even be here with him. Yeah. And the best I could do was walk up and give him a hug.
Yeah.
And he's like looking at me like, I'm German, you know, I don't hug. What are we doing hugging here? and it was such a relief to get to meet them and just to spend an evening there with them. And then it was just a little bit later, maybe a half a year later, they came out to Newport Beach here where I live. And they stayed with us for about 4 or 5 days. And I just gave them one of my cars and they drove all over Southern California and had a wonderful time and lived right there at the house with us. And so, yeah, it was just special. And now we just pretty much share, you know, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But if I get to Germany, I will certainly look them up. And I look forward to that. He's a winemaker in outside of Frankfurt, Germany. That's what he does. And just a really, really nice guy. And, you know, you go back to that 25%. I have to go back there because it just rang my bell. It's like when we find ourselves in these circumstances that can be so difficult, like your wife and also me or even my daughter, you look back and I can only remember Coach Wooden saying always that you should never compare yourself to another person.
Yeah.
There's not another person on earth that is like you. And I'll never forget teaching a small class, a young class of, I think, seventh graders. And a little girl raised her hand and says, well, I have a twin sister. And I said, well, let me ask you something. Does she like everything that you like? And she said, no, she doesn't. No, we see things differently. And I said, you proved my point. So never give up, never give in. When you don't know what the circumstances are going to be, you could be the 25%. You could be healed. You never know. You just, and that's so many of the things that Wooden taught us are so important when you're going through those very difficult times in life, which we all are going to have to do.
Yeah.
Sooner or later.
All right. Well, John, I appreciate your time very much. I've enjoyed the conversation and I wish you all the best.
Okay, David, I wish you the best too. Good luck with your podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.